The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, this week is Buddhist Earth Care Week. So once a year, there's a kind of local Buddhist custom of taking the first week of October to consider our care for our planet, our environment, the natural world. And so this morning I woke up with thoughts about talking about that little bit, and I read the news. And so I read about the mass killing in Las Vegas. And I thought about my 14-year-old son, who doesn't usually read the news in the morning, and he goes to high school. So I thought, I think I should tell him about this so that he can be a little bit prepared for what might happen at high school, what he hears, what other kids are talking about or something. So I told him that a single person in Las Vegas shot at a concert, and that back then 50 people were killed and many people were wounded. 400 back in the morning, they said. So I told him that, told him a little about it. And then I said, but you keep in mind, that was one person who did that. And there were thousands of people who came to help. There were many, many more people who were helping. And some of the news was about heroic acts at the concert, people who helped others who were wounded or threw their bodies to protect other people. And the relationship, the numerical relationship between the number of people in the world who do harm and the number of people who are ready to offer support and help, I think puts it in favor of the people who help. I think that it's easy to forget that there's a tremendous force in the world in human beings of caring and helping. Often in these kinds of situations that happened last night, a lot of the people who came to help and were involved weren't planning on it. It wasn't kind of on their mind. They weren't kind of gearing themselves up and thinking about how they could help. But that's what they did at the situation at the time. It's just kind of what you do in those kinds of situations. And at least for some people, for many people. So I wanted my son to have that in his mind. So he didn't just remember, just think about the one thing, this horrible thing that happened. Because sometimes we have these things happen and they weigh us down, or they just horrify us in such a way as we become paralyzed, or we think that's somehow the state of the world. This is how it is. And a lot of these things that people do sometimes are small, and they don't, the heroism, you know, this morning there was some articles on that kind of nature, and which is nice, but the 10,000, 100,000 small acts that people did that, you know, aren't mentioned. And so, and you know, there's lots and lots of people. I mean, I was trying to figure out how many people came to help and do something. And I just try to calculate, you know, there were, now they say 500 people who were wounded went to hospitals. And that large teams of people who had to come in the hospital and help those, you know, they had to call people in from all over to help. And then, you know, the medics who had to come and the police officers, it must have been quite difficult for the police to figure out what to do and how to respond and put their lives at risk and not know what they were dealing with. And I bet there was a big, you know, lots and lots of things showed up. And that's going to go on for a long time, the people helping. I think that the force of caring for each other is huge in this world. Unfortunately, just one person can make such a big difference to cause so much harm and damage. But I think that there's a tremendous amount of good in the world. And there's a tremendous amount of good in people who we sometimes think are our enemies, people who we think are somehow on the other side of some divide. And they say that sometimes wars are justified by somehow demonizing the other. And there's certainly a strong force in human minds to want to generalize, to demonize, to angelize people. But there's also a strong force to help, to be supportive, and it's a pretty instinctual thing that people do. And so I don't want to, pretend or make it pretty what happened or nice, but I also don't want to forget how people are changed by it. And some people are changed, dramatically for the better from these things. Some people are changed dramatically for the worse by it. I'm bitter and then go off and perpetuate further harm and damage. I think I've said this often here, now it's become somewhat well known locally, of a quote that came out of San Quentin prison. And Jacques Verdun was teaching this mindfulness program, meditation program, healing program for some pretty tough, violent background prisoners. And there were gang members in this program, and some of them were opposite gangs and pretty tough people. And they were talking at one point, or saying something about what they've learned in his program after a while. And one of the gang members said, what I've learned is that hurt people hurt. Hurt people, the ones who hurt others. And then this other gang member from another gang, rival gang, piped in, and he said, yes, and healed people heal. So which side of the, what do you emphasize? What do you do? If you're hurt, can you heal? If you're healed, can you help others heal? If you're healed, can you recognize the forces in our world that need to be appreciated and supported so that can grow and develop? So that was my train of thought at breakfast, trying to take care of my son, in case, I don't know what he was going to encounter in school. And and one of the things I've been thinking a lot about lately is that this movement to help, some people don't like the word help because some people think that the word help implies kind of a superior position, kind of like the poor people who are below us, we're going to help them somehow. There's kind of a distance that's not so... Some people don't want to be helped. But rather, another word people prefer is to serve. And for some people, the idea of serving is more equal, or is not so hierarchical, or the idea you serve or support. I like the word support. And so where is this movement of our hearts to support, to help, to appreciate, to nurture, to heal, to help, where does that come from in us? And I don't think it comes from, if it comes at a duty or obligation or requirement, or someone says you should do it, I don't know if that really works or that really speaks to the best in what's inside of us. I think that if we can help people to love, help people to not be closed, not hate, not be caught up in their greed, we want to support and nourish something that is a positive momentum, positive force that can come out of our own hearts. And how do we do that? And then in that positive force coming out, that then helping or supporting or nurturing is not a requirement, but rather it feels more like a natural movement. It's almost, some people say, you know, they didn't think they were helping. You know, oh, you helped a lot. Really? I just did what, you know, what I did. You know, it just seemed like the thing to do. I wasn't self-consciously thinking of helping. It's just this is what was required. And the kind of analogy that I'm fond of for this is when the right hand helps the left hand to wash itself, and the left hand helps the right hand, right? You know, for people who have two hands, that's kind of, you know, does the right hand thank the left hand and the left hand thank the right hand? You know, does the right hand demand to be thanked? I want to be recognized for what I did for you. It's, you know, it's just kind of what the hand does. We don't, it's kind of, in some ways, unself-conscious in that way. And it's possible to have that kind of momentum, movement coming from inside of us that supports the world. And so one of the responses I have to tragedies in the world, sometimes I don't know what to do in terms of the tragedy, but I sometimes take that concern, energy, and turn it around to myself to understand myself better, to be mindful here, to let my mindfulness kind of dissolve or work through some of the barriers that I might have that would get in the way of allowing the natural momentum of love, of compassion, of care come out of me, so that at some other time, some other circumstance, or even, you know, in relationship to this, I can somehow respond. And probably the most, one of the kind of maybe strong, big or some like example of this in my own life of how this might work is, you know, my response to 9/11 many years ago. And I felt that in the wake of 9/11, I felt, you know, it was a big deal for me personally. It was a big deal for everyone in America, pretty much. Well, it wasn't, you know, unique in that. But, you know, I felt that I was worried that after some months, after some years, people would just go back to how they were. And I felt in the wake of something as big as 9/11, it felt appropriate to be changed by it. And if I'm not changed by this, then, you know, am I capable of learning? You know, if I'm not changed by this, what good is that? And so what I decided to do was to start a Buddhist training, a Buddhist chaplaincy training program. And we had now for 15 years, 14 or 15 years, we've had a year-long training program that some of you here in this room have taken in training people or introducing people to the world of Buddhist chaplaincy and encouraging or supporting people to go and offer spiritual care in a lot of different settings. And we've trained people who've gone off to do spiritual care in hospitals and prisons and jails and hospice for homeless people. We've trained one person who went and did two people went and did police chaplaincy, working with the police. We had one, what else have we done, people have done? Educational chaplaincy. We had someone who became a college chaplain coming out of our program. And we've had just a few hundred people now go through our program in 15 years, and I call it a pyramid for joy. Pyramid scheme for joy. And I think it's legal. And because, you know, we train people here in this room, and they go out into the world and do their training and do their work and support people, and they come back and tell us, and it's pretty cool. I'm pretty happy with this. And so this idea of being changed, you know, so I was changed, and this is one example of what I did. And, you know, it's... And one of the things that chaplains think about when they work with people are four different, which consider human needs. So they listen, and the people I talk to, which of these needs are required right now? And what do I support them with? And the first need that's often mentioned is a sense of belonging, a place in the world, a place in society, a place with a community. It's very important for people not to feel alienated or feel they're cut off or not connected to anything. And so the idea of belonging is very important. And so how do you support people in that fundamental need to belong, to be connected? The second is a sense of worth. There's plenty of people in our society who have very little sense of self-worth. They don't feel like they count, they've been dismissed. Maybe they have the immediate family that support them and think they're worthy, but the racism in our country, the oppression in our country, the classism in our country leave some people feeling like they don't belong, like they don't count, like they're lesser than other people. I was told recently about someone who is a cook for spiritual retreats of many different types. And so she goes around these, and there's retreat teachers who teach these, you know, wonderful, inspiring retreats about something or other. And it seems like it's a lot of good in the world. But she said, you know, but you know, they, you know, they're up there on stage, they do all this good stuff, but I'm the cook, and they treat me really lousy. You know, I'm kind of like a second-class citizen, you know, I feel like I take advantage of, or just not, they're not really quite, you know, and supported and understood, and it's kind of like a blind spot. And so she gets the impression that she doesn't count for a certain kind of way. Luckily, she's a strong person, I know, and you know, she kind of can see through that and has her own place. But you know, our society often this idea of worth, it's powerful. What society as a whole can do to people, and then all kinds of things. The third need is that of being able to have a life of purpose, to have a purpose in what you do with your life and direction you're going. And so chaplains talk to people about their purpose and direction they have and where they get a sense of purpose. Chaplains, because they offer spiritual care, are often talking to people about how their own religion gives them a sense of purpose or meaning or something that they can tap into, often in times of crisis. And then the last of these four things is reconciliation. Many people have their relationships to their family and other places in the world deeply broken. And it's not uncommon for chaplains, like in hospitals, to be supporting someone who is maybe dying, but who is estranged from a family member or all the family members. And so then part of the chaplain's sometimes work is to help bring some kind of reconciliation between the estranged family members so that there can be some contact before someone dies or does something. So these are powerful, human needs that people have. And so we all have these kinds of needs. I think we all have a need for belonging and purpose and sense of efficacy and worth, and if we have broken relationships, to heal them in some way. So all this is kind of in the back of my mind as I was thinking about Earth Care today, the Earth Care Week, the care of the Earth. And it's very easy to be alarmed by the state of the planet and the Earth and global warming. It's very easy to be angry and upset. It's very easy to all kinds of things. But it's also difficult to love. It's difficult to be able to come from a place where it's the natural love, natural care, this natural movement of the open heart to want to do something and want to help. So rather than it being an obligation, it's like, of course, this is what I'm going to do. Now, some people might not be interested in doing that, but I think this is the work of what I'm interested in, is to try to help people, support people, to get in touch with their hearts, get in touch with their some deep inner motivation that can come, so that the impulse to support and help the world, the planet, people of the world, comes from a place of love, comes from a place of appreciation, comes from a place of seeing the beauty and the care and the mutuality. And so it becomes like the left and the right hand cleaning each other, rather than some burden and some sense of oppression, or I have to do something, it's so hard, it's hopeless and all that. And so in terms of Earth Care Week, I think the thing that I would like to support happen or see happen is just a deep, deep appreciation and love for our natural world. To see it as not separate from us, to see it as something that we can, of course we would care for it, if we understood the tremendous value and the beauty and the mutual way in which our life is dependent on the natural world. And what gets in the way of our hearts responding in this natural, almost instinctual way out of compassion and love. So it's all, even almost unself-conscious. Of course this is what we do. And I think each person would have to answer that for themselves about what gets in the way. But the way we can answer that question for ourselves is through mindfulness. If we can stop and pay careful attention to what's going on here for us, and really kind of turn the attention inward in a deep way, pretty quickly people start discovering what keeps them distracted. They discover what keeps them closed, discover what keeps them caught in the grip of forces which are the opposite of love and generosity. And it's mindfulness is a powerful microscope to really see what's going on here and to begin purifying or cleansing or emptying the things that keep our beautiful hearts from being able to connect and see the beauty in the world itself. And that's mindfulness, a kind of a way to discover a capacity to respond. But then we need to respond. And I think that to not respond in some way is not that we have to respond, but to not respond in some circumstance, I think, does a kind of violence to ourselves. And I think many people feel like something should happen in horrible situations, and they feel horrible about it, but then they don't do anything. They don't become they don't become different in any way. They haven't been changed. And so something closes up, or there's a wound that gets never closed, or it just becomes kind of a festering thing, or it becomes just one more kind of, little brick in the edifice of a difficult life. But to see if is there an appropriate way for each person in their own way to respond. So in 9/11, I didn't help in New York. I didn't go do anything there. I didn't help with terrorism whatsoever. That's beyond my pay grade or something. What I did do was start this chaplaincy program. So it's very indirect, but it was a response. What do we do with Las Vegas? We touched with it enough to want to be changed in some way. What about the hurricane in Puerto Rico and the hurricanes in the Caribbean and Texas? Are we, it's a big deal for many, many people. In what way does that change us? And it's not as a burden, but just, oh yeah, of course. This is what I want to do. So I wanted to read one Buddhist teacher who kind of approaches the issues of the earth, the planet, nature, I think in a very profound way, and with a kind of spirit and attitude which I don't hear very often when we, discuss the earth and environment and the environmental crisis of our times. And this is Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese teacher who's fairly old now, lives in France usually. And he's been one of the great champions of peace in our world. And he has this little book, and just the title of the book is worth knowing. It's called Love Letter to the Earth. Isn't that nice? This is a different approach to global warming and environmental problems. He writes a love letter to the earth. And so I want to read a little bit from it. In this very moment, the earth is above you, below you, all around you, and even inside you. The earth is everywhere. You may be used to thinking of the earth as only the ground beneath your feet, but the water, the sea, the sky, and everything around us comes from the earth. Everything outside of us and everything inside of us comes from the earth. We often forget that the planet we are living on has given us all the elements that make up our bodies. The water in our flesh, our bones, and all the microscopic cells inside our bodies all come from the earth and are part of the earth. The earth is not just the environment we live in. We are the earth, and we are always carrying her within us. Realizing this, we can see that the earth is truly alive. We are a living, breathing manifestation of this beautiful and generous planet. Knowing this, we can begin to transform our relationship to the earth. We can begin to walk differently and to care for her differently. We will fall completely in love with the earth. When we are in love with someone or something, there is no separation between ourselves and the person or the thing we love. We do whatever we can for them, and this brings us great joy and nourishment. That is the relationship each of us can have with the earth. That is the relationship each of us must have with the earth if the earth is to survive, and if we are to survive as well. So he writes a kind of long, lots of things, and in the end of the book, he actually writes his letters to the earth. It's a dear Mother Earth, I bow my head before you as I look deeply and recognize that you are present in me and that I'm a part of you. I was born from you, and you are always present, offering me everything I need for my nourishment and growth. My mother, my father, and all my ancestors are also your children. We breathe your fresh air. We drink your clean water. We eat your nourishing food. Your herbs heal us when we're sick. You are the mother of all beings. I call you by the human name Mother, and yet I know your mothering nature is more vast and ancient than humankind. We are just one young species of your many children. All the millions of other species who live or have lived on Earth are also your children. You aren't a person, but I know you are not less than a person either. You're a living, breathing being in the form of a planet. Each species has its own language, yet as our mother, you can understand us all. That is why you can hear me today as I open my heart to you and offer you my prayer. Dear Mother, wherever there is soil, water, rock, or air, you are there, nourishing me and giving me life. You are present in every cell of my body. My physical body is your physical body, and just the sun and the stars are present in you, they are also present in me. You are not outside of me, and I am not outside of you. You are more than just my environment. You are nothing less than myself. I promise to keep the awareness alive that you are always in me, and I am always in you. I promise to be aware of your health and well-being. I promise to be aware that your health and well-being is my own health and well-being. I know I need to keep this awareness alive in me for us both to be peaceful, happy, healthy, and strong. Sometimes I forget. Lost in the confusion and worries of daily life, I forget that my body is your body, and sometimes even forget that I have a body at all. Unaware of the presence of my body and the beautiful planet around me and within me, I'm unable to cherish and celebrate the precious gift of life that you have given me. Dear Mother, my deep wish is to wake up to the miracle of life. I promise to train myself to be present for myself my life and for you in every moment. I know that my true presence is the best gift I can offer to you, the one I love. Love letter to the earth. That's a whole different approach. You could go read statistics and numbers about what's happening to the planet, and that doesn't, does that touch your heart? So we live in a world that we're part of. We live in a human society that we're all part of. That Thich Nhat Hanh's call is that we're not separate. That in some ways, if the whole earth is who we are, and then we're all part of each other as well. And the sense of deep belonging to the human race, deep belonging to the human family, deep belonging to the earth, the planet, the other species, this cosmos, a sense of deep sense of being valuable and important, precious, because we're not different from the earth. This famous story, kind of fable from the time of the Buddha's awakening, that the last step before he became awakened and liberated, which is depicted here in our statue, you see that he has his right hand draped over his right knee, and the fingers are reaching down. And what he's doing is reaching down to touch the earth. And he had the sense that, he had this challenge, he was challenged that he wasn't really worthy of becoming liberated and free, opening his heart. And so then he reached down and he called on, the ancient Buddhists didn't call it the Mother Earth, they called it the Goddess Earth. And he called upon the Goddess Earth to bear witness to the appropriateness, his worth, to become free. And so the earth, they made a little earthquake. That was the language of the earth back then. And that was enough to for everyone to get the message that it was okay. And this idea that that somehow our connection to the natural world that is often forgotten actually teaches us something very important about our own inner worth and well-being. Not a few people will find they go out into the natural world, go stand at the beach, the ocean, and look at it, and it gives them a very different sense of who they are and how they are, and come back into society. And just a few days ago, we have a high school right down the block, right? And it starts in ninth grade, and ninth grade is, coming to high school just a few weeks ago. It started about a month ago, I guess, 6 weeks ago. And being a freshman, I guess it's difficult. It can be very difficult, right? And a freshman girl committed suicide on the train tracks just, a few blocks that way from here. And so there's, I don't know what happened to her, what's going on, but my guess is that some of what was going on, given this history of things like that for teenagers, a lot of it had to do with social challenges at home or in school or with friends or something. And then some people will have these challenges and find healing and nurturing by spending time in the natural world. And then a sense of purpose for our lives. I think that when we can open up to this capacity to love or to recognize what we love, then I think we know what to do. We'll find what to do in a very different way than if we don't know what we love. And if we love this world of ours, if we have an open heart that's really able to connect to people and to feel people and be with people, connect to the earth, the planet, the environment in a way that's meaningful, we will have our sense of purpose. We will have a direction. And if there is need for reconciliation to the earth, to our fellow humans in some way, and there's often a need for that because humans certainly can be cruel to each other. And I don't know if the earth is ever cruel, but some people, the natural world can create, it's a very dangerous place as well, and you don't want to romanticize it. And so how do we reconcile our relationship to that? So I'll end with a story that I heard this summer. I went back to the Zen monastery where I spent years training in the in the Big Sur Mountains south of here. And it's a place called Tassajara, and it's deep in the wilderness. You get to it by taking a dirt road 14 miles deep into the Los Padres National Wilderness. And right deep inside, it's one of the few private landholdings in this huge national forest. And periodically, there are forest fires there. And those forest fires can be pretty big. And they sweep through. And they had one in 2008. And so they had some many days to prepare, maybe a few weeks. And so they had a lot of preparations. And they put got more pumps from the river and put sprinklers on their system on the roofs. And I think they even put tinfoil around some of the buildings to clear the ground. They had fire crews that came down and stayed with them and helping them prepare them for the fire that was going to come, that they thought might come. And so finally the fire was coming, and I think maybe because of the wind conditions or whatever, the fire was coming larger and faster than they maybe anticipated. And the order was given that everyone had to evacuate. And the Forest Service, everyone has to go. And so even though I did all this work preparing for the expected fire, everyone started to leave. Everyone left. But there were five of the monastics who lived at the monastery who got halfway up the road to the civilization, and they kind of stopped, and I guess they thought about what they were doing. They had abandoned the monastery. And if no one was there, the fire would just go through without being stopped. So they decided to go back against the orders of the Forest Service, the fire department, and whatever. And so those five went back, and they had been trained how to handle the pumps and the water and stuff, and they got ready, and the fire did come, and they managed to protect the monastery. There's a few little things that burnt. There was a treehouse on the edge of the monastery that someone was lived in when that treehouse got burnt, and a few other small little sheds and things, but they were able to save the monastery. It's still there. So that's the ancient story, but the modern one, this summer, I met a retired fire chief who, after that fire, had become friends with Tassajara and had got involved with the volunteer firefighting efforts in the whole area down there. And he was at a meeting where one of these monastics who had been there and went back and took care of the monastery was asked, you stayed there to meet the fire. How'd you do that? How'd you manage that? Or what did you do? How'd you know? And so this is what I want to tell you, her answer. She said, we befriended the fire. Isn't that something? Instead of fighting the fire, which people say, right? We befriended the fire. That's a very different relationship to the natural world, the dangerous natural world. They made themselves safe by befriending it as opposed to fighting it, as opposed to seeing the enemy, that somehow you work with it, or you kind of understand it, or you befriend it. And I thought it was a beautiful thing. She recognized the danger they were in, the problem. It wasn't like saying that this beautiful natural world that we can love is all, Bambi and sweetness. But there are dangers, there are tremendous, there's hurricanes and all kinds of things that are part of it. But how do we live in this world? How can we love it? How can we befriend it so that we can coexist, we can reconcile, we can have, reconcile the divide, the pain, and all the stuff that goes on. So, this is Earth Care Week, and the Earth Care is not just our planet, our Earth and our natural world, but it includes all of us and the humans who live on it. And what would your love letter to the Earth be? Could you write one? And if you did write a love letter to the Earth, what would you say? And if you do write that love letter, I suspect that the earth will respond in kind for you. Just wait and see. Try it. So may we all care for the earth as just an extension of caring for ourselves. And may all of us support and nourish and cherish the goodness that's here in this world so that we can make a difference and prevent maybe the next massacre and tragedy that might come along. Or not come along because we made a difference. So thank you all very much.